extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time Club and Country, driven by Continental Tire. From the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios, I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer. Should we sing O Canada now, or should we wait until later? Top of the octagon, 16 points. El Tri comes to snowy Edmonton to the Commonwealth Stadium and loses. It wasn't quite 2-0, 2-1. Mexico poured it on at the end. It's a miracle that Canada got out without a goal at the very, very end of stoppage time. But they did it. They're top boys. It's their big night. It is Alphonso Davies running circles in 16-degree weather in a parka that goes down to his knees with the Canadian flag. It is Sam Adekunle jumping into a snowdrift that was so compacted that he almost bounced off of it. It is Kyle Larin bringing out the drum after tying Dero for the most goals in Canadian soccer history, for the men at least. This is, I mean, we'll get to the U.S. We'll talk U.S.-Jamaica and the result that was. But this is Canada's night. And it feels like the hierarchy in CONCACAF is changing. Dave, you are a resident Canada expert. Not citizen, wannabe citizen, Montreal resident, whatever it might be. Help us understand this as well as you can.
It's just from everyone I've talked to, you know, I think it was Dwayne Rollins that was referencing back to the last time Canada played Mexico and players were walking off the field with t-shirts that said fire the CSA. And now you're back here to 50,000 fans, a game that you outplay Mexico, a game that you could have probably won by more if you put away your chances. And just in a moment that Canadian men's soccer has never existed in, it's not just getting a result. It's outplaying opponents. It's the depth of the roster. It's the personalities of the players on this team. Alphonso Davies, born in a refugee camp and then moved to Edmonton. And now he gets to come back. And as you said, carry the flag around in front of his family and all of his friends, and to beat the best team in the region and a giant in this region. And so this is the biggest thing you can accomplish in CONCACAF. And Canada was able to do it today, and they built an event around it, and they wanted it to be this historic moment and a moment that the whole country would be watching. We've talked about it through this whole cycle because it started for Canada well before it did for Mexico and the U.S., with trying to get into what we thought would be the sixth spot in the hex on some dumb FIFA rankings. And then COVID happens and that shifts. And now you're fighting to get in through all these rounds of qualifying. And all of it has been building up, I think, trust from the nation that it's worthwhile to turn us on because we won't let you down. We can win. We can play at this level. And you see what it means to Larin. I mean, every goal that's been scored this week, Alphonso Davies has celebrated the most, and he hasn't scored a single one of them. Like, look at the Jonathan David goal against Costa Rica. Fonzie's the one who's, like, gone to the corner before anyone else and just loving life. So it's awesome to see. It's a huge moment for the future of the sport. And it's not just now, right? Like, this isn't a team that's peaking. This is a team that's on the upswing. And when you talk about 2026 and everything that's coming, I think this is a team that's representative of what's changed in the country and a sign that the sport has just shifted forever in Canadian history.
We're going to dive in deep. Any other thoughts before I sort of lay down what happened tonight and give people the context?
I'm just amazed it happened so quickly with Canada, because 2019 Gold Cup, this team went out, and it was largely this team. They went out in the most brutal way imaginable against Haiti. They blew a 2-0 lead in the second half. It looked like they were cursed. And then they had to go through, as David said, they had to go through all those multiple rounds of World Cup qualification. And they needed that own goal against Haiti. Like one of the worst own goals I've ever seen. And it seems like that, like a switch was flipped when that happened. And they realized that, I mean, Canadian soccer has been cursed for 35 years. And it kind of felt like the curse was maybe lifted on that night. And now here they are. They got their second life because of that. They got their second life because the hexagonal was expanded to the octagonal. Like, if it was a normal hexagonal, Canada would not still be playing. They did not qualify for the hexagonal. They missed out on it. But by expanding it, they got in through the back door. And now here they are at the top of the table, and they've earned it. They've played the best soccer out of anybody in this round of qualifying, and they deserve to be top of the table.
And tonight for me wasn't so much about the best soccer or anything like that. Canada looked much more of the experienced, savvy, hardened team of the two. From the first tackle from Donnell Henry getting into Chucky Lozano to the choice to play the match in Edmonton on a, you know, a terrible, what we can say was clearly just a terrible pitch and even worse conditions to play on the night. And Canada seemed the much more up for the fight from the beginning of the match. They get the, you know, even the down to the goal right before halftime, which was massive, where they were able to kind of press and get that opportunity, that chance. It bounces right off. Ochoa does not do well with it. And then Kyle Larin, also an excellent choice to play in this match, clearly with the two goals, but his hold-up play was strong. And Canada, even at the end, just like going down multiple people at a time, pushing, taking their time on set pieces, frustrating Mexico at every opportunity to after the match where Mexico just seemed to completely be rattled. Just, you know, they gave them a huge push at the end and Canada, except for sort of a goal line save, were lucky to walk away with 3 points maybe. But I thought Canada were the better team, the much more experienced and savvy team, which usually, to Doyle's point, you've seen in the past them being talented, but maybe not having that sort of finishing medal to come away with something from it.
So it's Canada, it's the U.S., it's Mexico, and it's Panama right there, the top four in CONCACAF, packed in from 16 to 14 points
after
the eighth night of of qualifying in the octagonal. So it's 16 for Canada, 15 for the U.S., as I said, 14 for Mexico, and 14 for Panama, tiebreakers keeping them in fourth. Then it's all the way down to 9 points for Costa Rica in fifth, 7 for Jamaica, of course, 1-1 draw against the U.S. tonight in Kingston, El Salvador 6, Honduras all the way down in 3. It feels sort of like a four-horse race at this point. Costa Rica within touching distance. Maybe Jamaica could go on a run and win a bunch of games in a row, but they haven't shown that yet, though they do have the two stars together. We'll talk about U.S. and Jamaica in a second. A little quick news here. 13 to 32 spots for Qatar are taken. CONCACAF has 4. 3.5, really. We hope 4. We'll see how that works out. Let's just dive into it. Before, I'll remind you, Thursday, go check out the 2021 Audi MLS Cup playoffs preview we'll do. Digging in on that one, we had a really good time. We did like an hour and a half show for the Kindle Awards on Monday, giving out all the hardware that's not given that we have moved into the void to hand out in Major League
Soccer. I think at the point we reached, it's just software. It's not even hardware.
Yeah, that's true. It's not. There's nothing physical about it.
So no.
Software is.
We got to get a trophy budget for next year.
Last year we did have trophies. Last year we
That's
did.
That's right. Yeah.
They were
can
the
we just
like,
get like chocolates
inch...
and wine that we can send out.
Yeah. We sent tires last year too. So I'm sorry to the 2021 winners, but we had a great time. We did like a 3-hour pre-show meeting just to get that thing nailed. So I hope you enjoy that one. And remember, go check out the Audi Bracket Challenge at MLSsoccer.com. Get your first try in. You can change it all the way up to the first kick of Union Red Bulls. Okay. In detail now. Canada, Mexico. I looked at it. 16 degrees at kickoff. Said weather.com, it felt like 13. That was a narrow field, a Canadian football field, but it was narrow. You could see a couple times balls that were sort of chipped in behind for Tejan or others going out of bounds before they had a chance, balls that you would normally see be in. We've looked up the Dosa Serra from 2001 just because we were curious. Dave's suggestion on this one, 29 degrees Fahrenheit that night with winds of 12 mile per hour. So it was, you know, wind chill was down, but this is colder by far. In the teens, you could feel it from the very beginning, from the singing of the national anthems. It was just like, oh my God, this is going to be absolutely ridiculous. The entire outskirts of the field is just surrounded by snow. There's a horn all game. I don't know where the hell that horn came from, but it was going all game long. It's like the recurring noises in CONCACAF tonight were infuriating. What do you think this game was like to play, Kalen? Like just physically, what was it like to play?
I mean, you know, I mentioned that first tackle from Donnell Henry, where he kind of gets
it. Are we calling that a tackle?
Yeah, it was a form tackle. He got his helmet down. He got his shoulder pad into him.
Exactly.
He did. It was shoulder to the face. So if you were already questioning whether you're coming off a tough match against the U.S. and you're thinking, okay, now we're going to really step into this game. There's a lot of cliches, a lot of managers do say to like put in that first tackle. And that one stood out to me as this is what you're in for today playing against Canada. And at every time Canada has played Mexico over the course of the last year, it's been like that. They've been up for the physical part of the game, and the Mexican team hasn't always looked to return that. And I thought, even when you look at how the goal was created, it's the shocking part for me is, from my experience playing against Mexican club teams, in CONCACAF Champions League, or whether it's just in preseason friendlies.
Superliga,
of course, respect, RIP. It's impossible. The most frustrating part is to try and you cannot pressure them, right? You cannot upset them with your pressure. And what we've seen from Canada and what we've seen from the U.S. actually is you can upset them with your pressure and you can upset them, and they haven't been able to play out. And when there were few opportunities where Mexico was able to break, they got one or two chances, I think, where Gallardo, I think, got down the line and one-on-one with Donnell Henry, where he's a little stretched a little bit. There was bad service in the box. You saw Tata's reaction after that. But they just weren't able to make the most of it. And for a lot of the times, the play where Alistair Johnson gets that shot off is off of a turnover where they are pressuring Mexico. They get the ball. He puts his shot on frame, and then they get the goal out of it. So I think the Mexican team has not been able to really build in the same ways that they have in the past. And credit to Canada and the U.S. for having, I guess, the personnel, the quality, and the athleticism, and just, putting this Mexican team under pressure, because it really has changed the trajectory of kind of how you can play against them. And they haven't been able to bypass it for the most part. And so I thought that was a huge part in the match tonight. And yeah, the elements play a factor. Playing that match in the cold is always going to be tough, and I think favor a team that maybe has an attitude coming into the game, which I thought Canada did. But I thought they set the tone early in the match, and for them to come out with a result like this with Kyle Larin stepping up huge, I mean, this was a historic performance. I mean, not just based on him matching De Rosario, but just as a singular performance for the night from him, and in a night where Alfonso Davies was good, but I think a lot of Mexico's efforts were spent trying to shut down some of the wing play, and Kyle Larin's hold up play and just physicality, toughness, and then savvy to get on the end of those. Yes, you can say Ochoa gave him a couple being planted on his line, and then also not being able to handle the shot from Johnson. But even defensively, Kyle Larin was massive in this game.
And I wasn't super happy, I think, with the lineup that John Herdman chose to go with, which, by the way, in its own conversation, is like, that's how far Canada has come. It used to be like, well, which player that shouldn't be in the lineup has to start. And now it's like, there are a bunch of options. And I think at what we've seen over the last year is that the five-man backline for Canada is when they've been at their most successful, both because of what they can do with their center backs to maybe protect Vitoria a little. Today was Donnell Henry from the start. But also the runway it gives the wingbacks, whether it's Richie, whether it's Tejan, Arcube, or Alfonso Davies. And I actually think Davies being pushed higher up sort of neutralized him at times. But his presence is what creates the turnover that lands on Alistair Johnson's foot for the first goal, right? He's what has Mexico so deep, and him pressing is what has them clear it out. So to Kalen's point, and I think to Herdman's credit, it creates that moment and it creates that goal. And then John Herdman didn't wait to make the change with Donnell Henry. He's sitting on a yellow card. He struggles with speed. He struggles going side to side when guys are attacking him. And so he made that move early. Now, it's bizarre to me that Steven Vitoria was good enough to play in the Azteca for 90 minutes and wasn't good enough to start today. And Marc-Anthony Kay as well, as much of a legend as Atiba Hutchinson is, which congratulations to him because he passed Julian de Guzman as the all-time appearance leader for the Canadian men's national team of tonight, which I am sure he did not see this one coming for the end of the road when he started and over the last 15 years. of playing with this team. But it was really cool to see for him. But yeah, so I thought Herdman, he made some tough calls. He picked Kyle Larin over Jonathan David as well, who's coming off a goal. I personally like to see them together. I think that's when they're both at their best. But Kyle Larin has been immense for this team. And when you look at the goal record for him, it's him coming to every game. It's him coming to the Bermuda games, starting in the Cayman Island games at the beginning of this qualifying cycle. And I think you look at for the Canadian national team over the last 10 years, and there's guys who choose to not even play for them. And then there's guys, Cavallini was part of this as well, who were like, get deeper and then I'll come. Like, I'm not showing up for the friendly versus Oman, and I really don't want to come to the game at the Cayman Islands. And Kyle Larin, to start qualifying when Jonathan David wasn't allowed to travel out of France, when Alphonso Davies was a little back and forth with Bayern, like when there was not every option available, he was committed to coming to every game and scored in all of those games to get Canada there. So it's pretty cool to see him come around and break the record and get the two goals in a game like this.
11 goals now, by the way, in this World Cup qualifying cycle. It's the most in CONCACAF. He's got 4 in the final round. Yeah, he's shown up. He's shown up. What stood out to you as to how Herdman approached this one, Doyle?
They didn't really try to play through the Mexican midfield, which is something that they had done down in the Azteca. They had actually controlled the game with the ball a little bit through midfield. But by playing that 3-4-2-1 with Tejan and Davies on that two line underneath Larin, it was all about just getting that one pass and then releasing into the channels. And knowing that, you know, if it's those two guys in a foot race against anybody in CONCACAF, like it's those two guys. And that, I think, like, that set the terms of the engagement, because Mexico was afraid to push up. Mexico was never going to play like Mexico because they were so afraid of having, you know, Davies or Buchanan get behind them. And like, Buchanan did a couple of times. Like, if Tejan had had a better game, like, this one could have gotten out of hand a little bit by the hour mark. And I mean, you know, credit to Mexico's defenders for scrambling pretty well and, you know, making him make tough choices, but like, they were hanging on by a thread. But I think that forced a disconnect between the Mexican back line and midfield in terms of just like, the back line was so pinned that there was no chance to compress the game, get on the ball, establish a rhythm, and start playing like the Mexico that Kalen was talking about, the Mexico that is always the one in charge of the tempo of the game. We didn't see that tonight. And that's compounded by the fact that, you know, Mexico's fullbacks, they were wingbacks tonight. They're not good. they are not good. And so they stayed really deep as well. So it was supposed to be a 3-5-2 from Tata. It became a 5-3-2. And of that midfield three, the only one who's at all dynamic is Aceace. You know, Orbelin Pineda is a nice player, but he's not take over a big qualifier type of player. And obviously Edson Alvarez is a great player, but like, he does one thing. He protects the back line. He doesn't do anything else. He's really good at that one thing, and that's it. So it all came down to like your 32-year-old midfielder who's not playing regular minutes in Spain, who doesn't have the physical capacity to cover like he used to, and is certainly not one of the fastest, you know, one of the best athletes on the field. He was the only one who was in kind of a hybrid role to shuttle from defense to attack. So for Mexico, it ended up just being Raul Jimenez trying to win a long ball and hold it up and maybe link with Chucky Lozano, maybe get Aceace forward. But actually, no, that didn't work at all. That's how Mexico ended up 65 minutes in the game. They still didn't have a shot. So I think just the way Herdman set Canada up, I thought it was too defensive. I thought it was a little bit too far afield from what he had done in the Azteca with how they played and worked so well. It turned out to be the exact right thing because it shifted the board and it prevented Mexico from getting numbers forward in sync. And if you don't, if you don't let your opponents do that, whether it's Mexico or anybody else, it's going to take something really, really special to beat you. And Mexico didn't have that really, really special tonight, and Canada did, and so they deserved it.
How well does this top three right now, the order Canada, U.S., Mexico, reflect the true hierarchy of things. Because I think somebody, I can't remember who said it early on, and maybe it was you, Dave, about like, this is the best that CONCACAF has to offer that Canada beat in Mexico right now. It's sort of it's not a moment that I can remember in this region in a long time, certainly not with Canada, but with sort of three teams that you would say either they're all equal, or if there's one that's not, it's Mexico.
If anything, yeah. You would say that if you were to just look at it and you hadn't watched any of the matches, and you'd say, oh, Canada's at top of the table. Have they played more home games? Have they not played Mexico, or have they not been to the Azteca yet? Have they not played against the US away? If anything, I feel like Canada, where they are on the table, actually doesn't show quite how good they've been so far. And yes, there's still a lot to do. And, you know, they're just sort of past the halfway mark here. But I think for anybody who would have questioned to say whether they were in the top three, you know, is this a team that can be in the World Cup? You know, absolutely. And when you look at like tonight, for me, it's pretty simple. It's, you know, if you're going to play a game in that type of climate, a lot of it's going to come down to winning your individual battles, winning second balls, being savvy, being smart, and being good on set pieces, rebounds. I mean, that's what it was tonight. Yeah. And each single one, if you made that checklist, they were the better team. They got on the edge of every single one of those battles tonight. And, you know, deserved the scoreline actually flattered Mexico in the end.
Yeah, and we kind of joked about it over the course of the week, but there was like Canada outplayed Mexico for large stretches of the game at the Azteca, right? If you played this game at BMO, which would still be freezing cold, but there'd be no snow, or at BC Place, where you'd be inside on turf, but you wouldn't obviously have the conditions. There's a chance that Mexico or Canada could play Mexico off the field, or you know, could play through Mexico and win this game. But I think the decision they made to play here in this atmosphere, in this environment, they all rallied around it. And when Kalen mentioned that, like, no one wants to play in this game, but Canada came in being pumped about it, where Mexico came in being miserable about it. And so I think Canada,
Ben Olsen, you're saying, and not the
sure.
Right. Like,
but it didn't feel like a necessity, right? Because we were saying before, oh, it's almost a shame, because we would have liked to see, to Doyle's point, talking about how they've played through the midfield before, or they've used their dynamic play and, you know, getting the ball on the ground and can isolate Mexico with the ball at their feet. And they showed they could kind of do it either way, where it could be this type of game, or they could potentially also, if you know, they can hurt you in another way. So whereas before you would have said, okay, maybe this is sort of a gimmick or a way to survive against Mexico, this just seemed like another option for this Canada team.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, again, they rallied around it, but the whole point is to get to the World Cup. They wanted to beat Mexico, and this was the way that they decided to go about it for this window, and it worked, right? They won 2-1. They're on top. They're, you know, pretty close to getting there. So I think that's a huge part of it. To your question from before, by the way, Mexico went to a Intercontinental World Cup qualifying playoff against New Zealand for the 2014 World Cup after the Sanssouci goal. So Mexico's been down before. Just to throw that out there.
It's fair. I have the Sanssouci goal commemorative image hanging in my wall in my office right now. I should have remembered that one. Can I ask this question? January 30th, U.S. in Canada. It's kind of been cat and mouse about where they're going to play that game and where U.S. is going to play Canada in the U.S. Would you play it in Edmonton if you're Canada?
No, I don't think so. I don't even know if it's physically possible. Like, I think
don't people Kyle in Edmonton said, actually hibernate during the winter?
Kaylin like, Kyle was talking about like Saskatchewan and -50s and like all different kinds of coats and sweaters, and I was like, this is out of my.
I was like, you live in Miami now. Past. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Florida. That seems intentional.
The two rumors are Toronto right now and Vancouver, and from what I've heard from people in Canada, they think it's leaning Toronto, which would be an outdoor game at BMO Field.
Because so I heard Rogers, Sky Dome.
Well, the Rogers Center or the Sky Dome, whatever it's called. I think they changed the way the infield is built, so you can't take it out anymore or cover it.
Right.
So you could play it, because clearly you could play on anything.
This is how we know we have a Canada expert on the show.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that David did not realize that Montreal is an island. I just want everyone to remember.
Just a reminder for you. Can I shout out Alistair Johnson and Kamal Miller in this one as well? I mean, they were just.
But that's, by the way, that's what didn't exist in 2019, right? Yeah. That's the difference in this team is it's not top heavy. It's not completely mismatched. And Steven Vittoria is a huge part of that as well. And I give John Herdman credit in the way he's brought Vittoria along and the situations he's put him in to allow him to sort of get comfortable in this group and gain confidence. But Alistair Johnson, Sam Adekube, and Kamal Miller, and Richie, those are the differences. Like, to have the ability to, if you need to sit back, you can defend. Also, when you attack with Alfonso Davies, if it's Adekube or Miller behind you, they can defend in space. They can defend 1v1. Scrambling.
Where he was like literally like Dikembe wagging after taking the ball off all three players, where he was like, it isn't for you. Like, tonight isn't yours. It's mine. I take that.
The early one, Raul Jimenez, he takes it off him, bodies him, and then he just starts clapping in his face.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a Gooch moment against Borgetti from years ago. And you could tell that he was up for it and he's been huge. And the other piece about this, you watch this game, and I think someone tweeted this out about the number of MLS players that have, you know, done this to Mexico over the course of this week.
18 of 27 U.S. and Mexico players who beat Mexico came through or in MLS. That's the stat.
And this is why it matters. You have three clubs in Canada. That's an opportunity. Richie Lurea is not playing in Orlando, but he has value as a domestic player to come to Toronto. He comes home, and now he's probably a World Cup starter. Kamal Miller, not getting playing time in Orlando. By the way, Orlando.
Yeah, maybe Kyle Larin, Orlando. I was like, watching this game, I was like, man, Orlando was scouting Canada pretty well there.
Kamal Miller has more value to Montreal than he does to other clubs in MLS because he's a domestic player from Canada. He cuts there. He gets a starting spot. He's able to get comfortable. He's able to get confident. Now he's a starter for the national team. And then Alistair Johnson going to MLS as well. It's a large part of why it's being built. And promising night for MLS in Canada because you've got a great coach in Vancouver and Vanni Sartini, great coach in Montreal and Wilfred Nancy, and now Tata Martino taking over at Toronto FC has a huge opportunity as well.
Oh, just slip that in. I mean, just the rhythm, the timing.
Does anybody on this podcast expect Tata Martino to still be the manager of the Mexican national team this time tomorrow? I mean, if JCO can survive 7-0.
Yeah, that's... I think I would be surprised because they're in such good position still to qualify. Like, between the schedule... The schedules, it's easier for them the rest of the way. But these they're going to sting a lot. Like, the pressure is going to be immense.
So, Mexico has 4 home games left, 2 road games. Canada has 4 road games left, 2 home games. So Mexico does have an easier path. They are only 2 points back. That said, they're tied with Panama on 3rd place. Like, this is not... I don't know whether or not Tata Martino is going to get fired. I think he's a great coach. I think they would be kind of crazy to fire him unless they had something really good lined up. At the same time, Mexico was butt this window. They were so bad in both these games. They weren't able to solve any of the problems that the U.S. posed last week and that Canada posed this week until the final 5-10 minutes when they just threw the kitchen sink forward and they almost got a miracle point. But that wasn't a point they would have deserved. You know, that would have been just like soccer's a crazy game and random stuff happens. And, you know, it's hard to argue that Tata Martino's made this team better.
To me, the problem is not qualifying. The problem is you brought Tata Martino in to get to the 5th game of a World Cup, to do something you've never done before. And this is not the best team you've ever had. This is not a team playing at a higher level. Like, with JCO, you could see the direction it was going in, and then it was this train wreck of one game. Where with Tata, it's like he didn't figure out anything to do if Raul Jimenez is out. He can't figure out how to change systems within games. He has not brought a second generation through outside of Cesar Montes. There's not very many examples of how Tata Martino has improved this group. And so rather than say, will they qualify for the World Cup? I think the flip side is, this is this enough time for someone else to do something? right? And that's where you have to look at it and say, if we get someone in tomorrow, right?
Yeah, because you have 2 months before the next window,
right? And so that's the only reason that I think if you're the FMF and you're looking at it and you're saying, are we going to win a knockout game in the World Cup right now? And it doesn't look like they will. And I don't think there's a ton of evidence to say that they've played better against better opponents. It's not like, yeah, we struggled at Panama. We played a rotated team at El Salvador. We got a win with the weird red card. Fine. But like, that's not what we're focused on. I don't know that you could say under Tata that they've been better against better teams.
Tough moment. We will see the headlines. What will they say in the morning? Will they be mourning? Or will they be saying adios to Tata Martinez? It's a big question.
Well, I just want to say, like, right now, I have Twitter open, and Mexican media is just savaging Memo Ochoa. Just absolutely. And I get it. He was terrible tonight. He certainly gave the U.S. some fuel before that game. At the same time, to bring it back to what David was saying, kind of, like, who could Tata Martinez have brought in? You know, like, there is no... There has been no heir to Memo Ochoa. Like, they started looking 7-8 years ago to see who was next in line, and there's nobody from Mexico.
David Ochoa.
That's the answer now. Like, we could very well see David Ochoa in January in that window.
Was this the Snochoa game? I'm sorry.
Memo Ochoa was bad, but I still think the biggest problem for Mexico has been in the attack. For the longest time, it felt like, oh, once we get Raul Jimenez back, everything is going to click. And that was kind of the, oh, well, we don't have a striker. And then there were calls for call back Chicharito, he's scoring goals. And it was, no, Raul's our guy. And Funes Mori is just kind of going to be able to hold us over until then. Well, now they've got Raul back and they haven't been able to use the best of him. Like, we know what a talented striker he is and how deadly he can be in the box. And it's not like he's getting volume opportunities and just not himself. He's not getting chances. He's not getting looks in the box and he's not connected with the wingers. And there's nothing dynamic coming out of the midfield for Mexico at all. Like, nobody is making sort of dynamic third.
I got to tell you, like, this is making me want to pour a drink, man. Like, I haven't felt so good about Mexico being so bad in a long time.
So here's the two-match window. Canada, 6 points. Panama, 6 points. And that is maybe the best story, if not the biggest, in CONCACAF right now, with Canada obviously being the biggest. U.S. had 4. Decent window. We'll talk about them in a second. Costa Rica, a big win late today. Pushes them to 3 points in the window. Jamaica, 2 draws. They haven't lost since Austin, but they're not getting wins, so they're not picking up points to climb the table. El Salvador got a draw in the first game, and then Mexico and Honduras, big fat zeros in this two-game window. Now, it was Mexico's most difficult, as we said. Here's Canada's schedule, by the way, the rest of the way, just to kind of map this out as they sit atop the octagon. At Honduras, home against U.S., at El Salvador in the next three-game window. You've got the break into March, then it's at Costa Rica, Jamaica at home, and then at Panama. And that at Panama game, depending on what happens, could be a massive, massive game. We've kind of been preaching at you about Panama and their role. Well, they're keeping it interesting for the top three. Those are the automatic spots in CONCACAF. We know that. Without them winning games, this might just be sort of dusted. You know what I mean? Like, it might be just the U.S., Canada, and Mexico saying, well, we're going to play this thing out and get good results, and we'll be fine. No stress here, but... last 4 games for Panama, they have Mexico away, they have U.S. away, and then they home against Canada. So if they can hold against Costa Rica and Jamaica and get to that point, man, I don't know. Anything could happen. If you're John Herdman, what are you thinking over the long winter? And what are you thinking if you're a Panama fan right now?
So I think for Panama, this next window is fascinating because you're playing Costa Rica and Jamaica, who are right behind you, and then you're at Mexico. So like, if you're ahead coming out of that window, then I do think there is hope. But... you have Costa Rica host you. They have the opportunity to start that window off by saying, like, we are back. We do have enough pieces
we
to
have
get
a chance,
to another
basically.
World Cup. Yeah, and Jamaica the same. So I think that's what's fascinating about that window for Panama and that opportunity before you go into the meat grinder, that is, to close out your season. Also, you mentioned Canada's schedule in there. I think that's where you get the idea of playing in Toronto, because the travel to Central America is a lot easier out of Toronto. And you have to go Honduras, back, and then back to El Salvador. And so playing in Vancouver, I think, makes that just a little bit tougher, which would be unfortunate, because I think it would be cool to have Vancouver, who has hosted a lot of really big games for Canada before, to host some of those games.
Yeah, as Andre says in the chat, Goss just guiding us through our options here. Welcome to Canada Travel. I'm David Goss. Like, you want to go to Toronto, you'll start in the six. You maybe make it to Vancouver the in that second window.
Yeah, Brampton, baby. Flights. Right, Kalen?
Brampton is ready to host a match. Yeah. Everybody's getting, the whole team's going for some home-cooked meals. Everybody can do just, you will just stay right at home. Yeah.
Anything we want to close on with Canada before we go to the U.S. So ahead of this nice warm winter for John Herdman and the boys?
I wouldn't be shocked if this team gets better. Like, Ike Ugbo comes into this group, 23 years old, out of the Chelsea Academy, scoring goals in Belgium. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more dual nationals who choose Canada over the next 2-3 months. This has been the moment that they've been waiting for, which was a part of the pitch besides help us turn this around. And Ugbo said in his conversation when he announced that he was joining Canada, was like, I watch Alphonso Davies. I love Jonathan David. Like, that's the new argument. It's the same that it was for the U.S. with Jorginho Dest when Tyler Adams and Weston McKennie and Christian Pulisic were part of that pitch. And you've got a bunch of different players. And I'm not saying Canada needs these pieces, but I wouldn't be surprised if you saw a few new names that were available to them coming into the January window.
2-1 Canada. Huge win. Right now, John Herdman thanking the entire city of Edmonton in his press conference for making it a fortress. So that's just a wonderful night. It was every scene, every moment. I mean, those are the things that stick, you know, for decades, for a long time, building a culture, building, I don't know, building joy, building something that you care about, that you like build your life around. What a night for Canada. What a night for all those players, for John Herdman, for every fan that's been there for every miserable result in Honduras or elsewhere, because there have been many. There have been many. And what you said earlier on, Doyle, stood out to me of just like the speed at which it happened. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes when, you know, we're sitting here thinking about it and talking about it and watching it every day, it sort of feels like a long time, but it has been just snap, bang, boom. They go from sort of a laughing stock to a true power, and perhaps changing this hierarchy. All right, let's talk U.S. We were feeling real all quick, those good vibes.
Real quick, I do remember talking to Jonathan Osorio in Brampton, and this was a couple years ago, I think maybe in 2019, and he was like, we want to qualify for the World Cup. We don't want to just – because I was asking him a question about 2026, frankly, and the World Cup coming there, what would that be like? And he was like, we want to qualify like for this tournament. And I remember thinking like, all right, well, that's nice, you know, and like maybe, but like to Doyle's point, the format changed and, you know, a lot of different things were against him at this point. I don't even know if Alphonso Davies, he was like 17, kind of like doing TikTok dances with Kai Kamara. So he's just kind of like hanging out, Giles Barnes.
Also leading the Gold Cup and scoring at that age. But
was he? Okay. And this might have been the year, but this might have been 2018 then. I don't know. Anyways, that life comes at you fast. He wasn't lifting Champions Leagues, we'll put it that way.
No. No, he was not.
Yeah. But no, credit to Canada. And it was, for all of us that have been following tonight definitely felt like a historic night for them.
So those of you above the border, north of the border, who often email or text and say you do not cover Canada with enough respect, whether it be MLS or the national team, I want to hear from you. I want to know how it feels. I want to know what you're thinking. I want to know those crazy dreams for 2022, for 2026, for beyond. I want to hear from you. Hit us up 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com.
Let's talk. One thing that I love that I heard, by the way, so far is that the Voyagers apparently the players were undecided if they wanted to fight Mexico or go to the fans, and so a lot of the players were just going back and forth. They were like shuttling between going to celebrate and then running back to the fight, and then another group would come over. So it sounds like it was a pretty fun time.
You gotta have rotation.
Yeah,
you know, it's called spatial awareness.
Keep everyone fresh.
Yeah, but you know what? Rotation. All right. Any other Canada thoughts? I'm just last opportunity here. That's all we got. All right. Slightly. The vibes aren't as good for the U.S. They were really good after that Mexico game. They're just okay, but okay is pretty good. Doyle, 1-1 draw in Jamaica. They go up and we're all raving about Timothy Weah, and then Mikel Antonio just like thunderbolts a ball that I don't know would have ever stopped, would have like plowed a field had it landed on the ground. I mean, an absolute golazo. And it's 1-1, and it's a little disappointing. And there's a lot of starters out, including those by suspension, but also because of injury. Where do you stand after this result for the U.S.? Do you have one word for it? Do you have sort of an overlying feeling about how it marks this window, these two games from the high of Mexico now to this, not high, but not low?
Wake up call, I guess. It's not one word.
Doing a lot of work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you put me on the spot there. True, I was going to say meh. I think that, look, the first 20 minutes of this game, it looked like the U.S. had bottled what they found against Mexico and brought it with them. And, you know, it could have been 2-0 if Andre Blake doesn't make a fantastic save on, I don't remember whether it was Ricardo Pepi or Brendan Aaronson. It could have been 2-0. And then, you know, the Mikel Antonio hits the Galazzo, and like the wind came out of the U.S. sails. And in this game, it was about the U.S. not being able to impose their will through midfield. And partially that was just like, look, Gianluca Busio is a good young player. He had a lot of trouble through 75 minutes. Like, he just could not find the game at all on either side of the ball. He was kind of an orange cone on a lot of Jamaica's best movements. But part of it was that, like, the U.S., whenever Mikel Antonio would find a gap, Jamaica would just play over the U.S. midfield. Jamaica would just play right to him, and he was winning all of those balls. He was bringing everybody else into the play. It's the difference between link play and hold-up play. Like, link play is like, okay, I'm being clever. We're in a good flow. I'm going to find a yard of space. I'm going to hit a nice one-touch pass. Hold-up play is like, I'm going to bring this defender with me, and I'm going to keep him on my back while I control this outlet pass. And as I control it, I'm going to, you know, then turn and go at goal, or I'm going to, you know, bring my midfield forward. And that allowed Jamaica to turn it less into a game of like a midfield battle and a game of like potential breakouts. Like, there was a potential breakout on one side, then there was a potential breakout on the other side. And the U.S., that's not how they want to play under Greg Berhalter. Like, they can do it a little bit. They have the right, if they have the right personnel on, but they didn't really have the right personnel on for this one. And it just kind of got away from them, and the U.S. weren't able to at any point put a foot on the ball, start knocking it around, and take control of the game back. And that's how you ended up with, you know, the last 70 minutes, but I mean, really the last 30, the U.S. just kind of hanging on for dear life, hoping that, you know, they wouldn't give up a bad goal off a set piece or a broken play. And I mean, they almost gave up a goal on one of each of those, and they got lucky to get out of there with the 1-1 draw. But sometimes you need luck. You know, like, the U.S. had no luck last time through in qualifying, Cuba and other places. They got a little bit lucky this time, and the hope is that they can learn from that, take them with them into the next window, which is, you know, 2 months from now, and start creating maybe a little bit of distance between them and that fourth place slot.
There you go. That's all.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah.
No, it was kind of a crappy game, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it was.
It was. It was a letdown from what we just experienced on Friday, and it was always going to be. And I said this in the spaces we did after the game ended, but USA versus Mexico, it's our Super Bowl, right? It's the big moment. It's the big event. It's everything we build around. It's like League's Cup. It's not there, but it's similar. And so everything was built towards Friday night. And then
I've been trying to wrap my head around that. I was like, oh my God, he dropped that bomb just directly on top of my head. And I'm like, what?
But it was such a high. And you even think about it for the players, right? For Timothy Weah, he came into the national team. I think his debut was that friendly against Bolivia at Talent Energy Stadium after we hadn't qualified for a World Cup. And then we played like Ireland in a swamp somewhere or something like that. Like, he went from that to this and has that moment in TQL, the environment, the atmosphere, the quality, like all of that's there. And so it was always going to be a letdown to go on the road and try and deal with Jamaica in this game, to not have the same atmosphere, even if it was against you, for it to be a full stadium probably would have gotten the team up for it. And so it was always going to be different and it was always going to be tough. And then you lose Miles Robinson, who's one of your erasers, especially in a style of game like this was. And to everything Doyle said, you know, Jamaica was happy, is always happy to play long. And Miles Robinson is phenomenal when he's going back towards his own goal. He's good in the air. Like, he could have done, he does a lot of the things that Walker Zimmerman does well, who was probably man of the match for the U.S. And then you lose Weston McKennie, who, for all the things he does, one, I think he's an emotional leader for this team. And two, he's a flair player, like, in a unique way, not like Ronaldinho or Messi, but he pops up and makes things happen in moments where other players don't. And so you're missing, I think, two good pieces coming out of that game that maybe could have helped you keep a level a little bit higher for this one. So that was always going to happen. But you talk about being lucky. I mean, you have to be good to be lucky, right? You have to be in a spot. And the U.S. in the last round of qualifying would just lose games like this. I mean, we lost 4-0 at Costa Rica. If the U.S. has gotten lucky with a call in Costa Rica, they would have lost 3-0. It wouldn't have mattered. And so that's the difference that you're seeing with this team and what they can do and what they bring to the table. And I thought they had some segments of the second half where they played well. I thought they started to find, similar to the game in Austin, they found Brendan Aaronson in a pocket of space along the left side out of halftime more consistently. And Anthony Robinson had a few runs into the box, and the U.S. had chances and had looks. It just wasn't there. But in the end, if we told you in an abstract the U.S. is going to go to Jamaica and get a tie in qualifying before the whole thing starts, you'd say you take that result.
Absolutely. But the only thing I would say is, like, when you talk about a trip game or a game that we always knew was going to maybe be a letdown after this emotional lift of beating Mexico 2-0, that's not really what happened. Like, they came out in a good way, and the goal from Weah was like kind of felt like a big weight off, as far as saying, oh no, this isn't, there's no fans in the crowd. This is a difficult, you know, it's a difficult atmosphere in a different way, where you're going from this huge emotional match to now playing, you know, in a difficult circumstance. And I thought Weah's goal and Weah's play in general was really big, as far as kind of giving that energy and giving that push and finding that moment of quality, honestly, from a player who, yeah, without Christian Pulisic in the starting lineup and with Gio Reyna still injured, has really taken a step forward this window into saying, hey, I should be a starter on this team. Like, you're going to have to take this spot back. And that was something that I was, you know, was a big relief for the team. And then honestly, that goal, sometimes I, you know, I've been in the situation where just a goal can just knock you flat on your back, you know, and you're just like, oh man, because it kind of came a little bit out of nothing. It's not like they had been pressuring so much at that point. It was just such a wonderful play by a special player. But, you know, the thing was, we've criticized the U.S. men's national team in the past to say, well, even in our good performances and our wins, it's been in the second half where we've made the push. And this was one where we felt like, oh, we finally got a good start in the match. And then the disappointing part for me was more that they got to halftime. Yes, the wind was knocked out, but they weren't able to get it back in the second half. We weren't able to see those same changes that we've seen, or a new life or a new formation or a couple different wrinkles to give that team some new energy. And maybe that's where it comes down to some of those depth pieces, where you're going down maybe one step further. And yes, Christian came in and had an incredible, you know, sort of important goal, but I wouldn't say against Mexico he had much of a rhythm, right? He just got into the right spot at the right time. And clearly, stepping into a game like this, I think overall, Jamaica's physicality really upset the U.S. I think it was one of those where, even on the play where Timothy Weah gets the goal, it comes from a 1-2 where Jamaica's being overly aggressive in the tackle to bite, and he plays the 1-2 and then goes. And then even the tackle, he's sort of playing the man instead of the ball, and Weah's able to kind of use his athleticism and sort of just kind of burst to get around him. But there just wasn't enough. It just wasn't clean from the U.S., and that's where it gave Jamaica and that physicality an extra chance. And then from there, honestly, Jamaica should have won. I mean, Jamaica had clear sitter, yes, goal called back. Should have counted from my perspective, but yeah, I guess you could say the U.S. if for not a good match and not a good second half, especially, you'd take the 1 point, 4 points from the window.
Yeah, I said it on the Twitter spaces. I just feel like the U.S. dictated the sort of the pace and intensity of play and style of play against Mexico. And I thought that after that goal by Antonio, Jamaica did. They turned it into like second balls, direct, over the top, play into the channels, win physical battles. From the very start, they were tossing orange cards down. Like, they had three or four tackles in this game that in a different world, depending on the referee, depending on VAR, which we'll talk about in a second because it sounds like video review is coming to the octagon, could have been red cards. That I think, you know, Charlie was very sure, and of course we share a booth for Instant Replay to talk these things every week, so I know his sensibilities pretty well, and we often agree. Charlie was pretty sure that that would never be a handball, and so was Christina Uncle, and I trust her. But there was, like, the Chris Richards play, there was some lunge and movement toward the ball. It is not out of the realm of possibility that with video review or just a different referee in a different moment, that's a handball. Bobby Reed is going to be like on his pillow tonight, just distraught that he missed that chance. And Kaylin, I've heard most people say they think it was a foul on Zimmerman, but you didn't. So yeah, I mean, this was not a shining example of what we want the U.S. to be, but it was a shining example of a good result, I think.
A point on the road is a good result. If the U.S. takes care of business at home and gets points on the road from here on out, they will make the World Cup easily. So I don't think anybody can complain too much about that. They have to play better, though. They have to learn from this and play better. And to your point, Weeby, about the pace of the game and how, like, just how it played out, the U.S. won 67 duels against Mexico last week. 67. That's a lot of duels. Mexico only won 48. 67 is what the U.S. won. Tonight against Jamaica, 65 duels total. Total. So the game was so much slower. The U.S. weren't able to leverage that ability to create confrontations in central midfield, especially, and to take those moments and turn that into their advantage by playing, you know, quickly to the flanks or quickly into the channels or quickly directly to Ricardo Pepi. I mean, think about how Ricardo Pepi's link play helped unlock Mexico and even helped unlock Jamaica early in this game. So the ability to make the game hectic to their own advantage sort of disappeared in this one. And that is something the U.S. has got to learn to do, because they have a lot of guys who are really suited to that, as Tyler Adams says, big engines. So they're really suited to that type of game, but are also good soccer players as well. So they can take that and turn it into more than just long balls. They can turn it into like really precise breakout moments. And we've seen that from them. And they never were able to impose that on Jamaica at all. And so in that sense, it was disappointing. And the hope is that they're able to learn from it.
I also think that that's not a CONCACAF game. And we've talked about this with Canada a couple times. The three best games Canada has played were against Mexico twice and the U.S. once. And I think as we get into a time period where a lot of the players that start on these teams play pretty consistently in four or five leagues in Europe and not as often in this region or in different regions around the world, like, I think maybe the game becomes a little more homogenous for them. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on who you are and what you like, it doesn't really matter. The U.S. does this six more times and then they don't do it again for 5 years, if that, because then you've got 97 teams in the World Cup and it's just a coin toss and everyone shows up to the same country at the same time. So, like, I do think that this is a problem for the U.S., but I don't think it's something that's going to keep coming up. You go away a couple more times, including at Mexico, which will be the test that it is. You're probably going to be in a low block for a decent amount of that game and trying to hit on the counter. And you're going to go to Canada where they'll probably open it up a little bit for you and you can play the soccer you want to play. But I just think that's a reality of the region, of the, you know, the way the fields are set up, the physicality that teams come to you with, and the way they want to play. El Salvador was like the one game that was set up for the U.S. and they did sort of play the soccer they wanted to play. They just couldn't score goals in that game. But I just think that's the reality of what CONCACAF World Cup qualifying is.
I think there was a reality in the sense of the pitch, too. It would not look to me to be conducive to like a fast-paced, hectic game in a lot of ways. It would be conducive to second balls in the air, winning those sort of battles, and that's what it was. Can we talk about the different moments here for the U.S. that the referees could have affected? And I'm curious, Kaylin, your opinion on the Zimmerman one. Is that the one you're saying no foul for you? Damian Lowe, header should have stood?
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Have you lose Kaylin, or is it just
me? We have also lost Kaylin. I was going to, he was going to say,
you know what happened?
Zimmerman down.
You know what happened? It's that referee mob. It's like the goalkeeper. Right, club,
cut it.
But the referees. Rich Hernandez probably snuck in here and just chopped a couple wires real quick.
Got that monopoly on the
I'm gonna make the defense of Walker Zimmerman. Walker Zimmerman won everything in the air tonight. Like, and he has ups. Like, the man can jump. And we're seeing him win towering header after towering header, and like all of a sudden he forgets how to jump. Because that would be the only explanation for him not being fouled on that play. Like he must have forgotten it. Either it's a foul or the man forgot how to jump. So I'm pretty sure it's a foul. Like, I'm pretty sure there's an angle where you'll be able to see Lowe's hand on Zimmerman's shoulder, preventing him from getting off the ground and winning yet another header.
It looked like maybe two hands to me. But again, like, video reviews coming to CONCACAF, man. And I'm going to tell you right now, that is not the end of all refereeing strife in the region. that is simply a that's the KitchenAid mixer, baby. That it's just going to mix it all up in different ways, because it still comes down to the human element. Like, what is clear and obvious? What is the call on the field? What do the people in the booth think? How does it all come together? What do you think about VAR coming into this?
I think it's crazy that it's coming in right in the, not even right in the middle, and like we're past the middle part of qualifying. It's coming in for the last six games, and it just feels like you're changing the rules. You're changing how the game's officiated 60% of the way into the tournament. That's this. I don't understand, man.
That's
not
less
understand.
Crazy to me than the fact that this wasn't done before.
Yeah,
you had 3.5 years
in this era.
This.
You do a whole qualifying cycle without video review when basically it is
you had
that decides who goes to the World Cup in your final qualification before you host the thing,
and the five of the eight teams have been clinched for 3 years, so at a minimum you could have set those up and then you go and deal with the rest of it. That's the part to me that is ridiculous. I don't know, it's going to continue to be entertaining. Like, you think anyone's going to stop yelling at refs and being confused, and fans are going to stop being upset? No, it's just going to get worse, which is amazing.
Would have been more clear with video review. I can tell you that is not necessarily the case. Like, it introduces new variables into the system is all. Instead of just being like, well, that's a call on the field, keep it rolling. You're going to have a lot more to think about in that sense. Can we real quick? We'll talk about that more later on. I can't do more refereeing talk. They got lucky. That's what it comes down to. Those calls could have gone the other way, and it didn't in this case, and the U.S. got a point out of it. Talk about the goal from Antonio. Could Stefan have saved it? That's been sort of the question that, U.S. soccer Twitter, which has been very into and in tune with the Turner-Stefan positional battle, and that's gone back and forth and been a big storyline. Could he have saved it? Could Adams have done more? Like, is there blame to be
Adams,
handed out on that
Adams
goal?
Adams could have done more, for sure. Okay, so if you
but
go
does
back
the blame lie on Tyler Adams? Is there blame just like sits on one person or two people and shouldn't have happened?
There rarely is. It's goals in soccer are often a cascade of failures, right? And failures at the margin, and that's what we're talking about here, because this is like, this was a golazo from Mikhail Antonio. But like, if you go back and you watch the clip, starting at midfield when Antonio controls that long ball, Adams, instead of getting touched tight and just slowing him down, turning him backwards, making him hit just play it square, whatever, he tries to jump a passing lane and he jumps the wrong direction. And that allows Antonio to turn and like stride directly into the attacking third in a rhythm. And Adams tries to recover. He scrambles back. He gets him. But then Antonio just chops him and turns inside and is able to step through it. So that's a mistake from Tyler Adams. Like, if Tyler Adams had played that correctly, Antonio does not get to wind up like that and hit a Thunder Bastard.
But you can't take that out of Tyler's game, though. Like, that is the freedom that makes...
No, you can't. You have to make that play where you don't let the most dangerous player on the opposing team stride into the attacking third with the ball.
I totally disagree with that.
And then on for
they'll probably kick me off the show again, but I totally disagree with that. Just in the sense that his job in that position is to make that bet. That's what makes him Tyler Adams, is to say, I'm either going to jump the passing lane and take a bet, or I'm going to play it safe here and protect the back line. And the reason he's able to make that bet is because he does have the elite recovery speed to recover, and which he actually does. He catches Mikel Antonio and actually overcommits a little bit to beat him, slows it down. But that's the job at that point once you're beat, is to just slow him down a little bit, bring him a little bit inside. When a guy pulls up from 35 and bangs a shot like that, and you've already tracked him down once, I don't know what you can do other than to just say, hey, congratulations.
No, what he could have done was play the position correctly from the start. He makes a mistake at the start of the play, Kalen. Like, he does. And it's not a huge one. And 99 times out of 100, it's not fatal. But that one time was tonight.
I'd understand if he didn't have a back line around him, but the guy, he gets a shot from 35 yards out. That's ultimately how the play finishes, right? He shoots from 35 yards out and smacks the thing into the upper corner.
Yeah, he banged it. It took that, but like this is what we're talking about. We're talking about the margins, and the margins when you're playing against a great player, one of the leading scorers in the Premier League, they get smaller. Mistakes like that can end up looming large. And then as for Zach Steffen, look, Brianna Scurry said it on Halftime Paramount Plus. Tony Miola said it on his show as well. Steffen got his footwork all wrong on that. And like, you could see it on his leap. He's you know, he gets no push off his left leg, and he's going up with two hands sort of waving at it instead of going up with his right hand. That's how, like, that would have been the correct footwork and the correct technique to save that. I'm not saying he should save it. I don't know if Matt Turner saves that. But there, like, that was not a shining moment for Zach Steffen. That actually kind of shone a light on some of his weaknesses in terms of technique. And this is a repeated thing with him. He does not get up well, right? Think about the goal he gave up against Northern Ireland earlier this year. Like, he was very slow getting a push. He got beat high. Think about the goal against the Red Bulls in 2018 playoffs. Danny Royer beat him straight over his head. He just was not able to get that push. So this is a repeat thing with Zach Steffen. Again, I don't, like, it was a Galazzo. I'm not saying that he should have saved it, but
I also disagree with that. You can find any goal that, you know, Matt Turner gets beat low to the back post. I can find three goals in his career that happened the exact same way. Like, sometimes a goal is just an absolute banger. And like,
things can be two things. Kalen, things can be two things. It's an absolute banger, but it's also something that he should have done better on.
So whose fault? Who do you put more blame on? Tyler Adams or Zach Steffen? Because they're both, from your logic, they're both
Tyler Adams. Tyler Adams. Yeah.
For giving up the shot.
For not just giving up the shot, but for letting Antonio get comfortable on the ball, letting him stride into the attacking third in rhythm. And like, you can't do that. You can't do that against the best player on the opposing team. They didn't let Christian Pulisic do that. They didn't let Tim Weah do that. Tim Weah was able to inflict that upon them. But this was like, Mikel Antonio did not have to work hard to get to that point. He hit a thunderbolt. But like, the U.S. did not make it as hard on him as they should have. And that was primarily on Tyler Adams. In the grand scheme of things, though, this was just, it was a Galazzo. Like, it was more Mikel Antonio being amazing than it was Tyler Adams making a 5% error here and Zach Steffen potentially being 8% better over here. Right? Like, these are the margins that we're talking about with players who are this good.
And my God, that was good. I mean, he hit that thing, and you just have to marvel at the power and the precision. What a debut here, goal scoring wise, for Antonio in CONCACAF with the little dink in the last game and then this one. What'd you think about the changes for Berhalter, Dave? Busio in, of course, for McKinney, and then Chris Richards. We haven't said either of those names yet.
Sorry, Tata Martino just got asked if he's going to step aside and why he thinks that this team doesn't have the soul to wear the Eltree jersey. So I've been slightly locked in over the last few minutes. On the two changes, I think Richards made sense. And I talked about this in the pregame. To me, Richards is the solution to a lot of questions with the U.S. men's national team. And it's, oh, you think you're going to have more of the ball? You want to pass out of the back? Then maybe John Anthony Brooks comes into the team. He struggles going forward and back, his athleticism, but he's the cleanest player on the ball. If not, maybe it's Mark McKenzie. But Mark McKenzie's been iffy defensively, and who does he partner with? And then you look at Walker Zimmerman and his ability to just come forward and dominate in the air and chase players down and all those things. Richards can do all of that. And so I think Chris Richards, if he can elevate himself to a level to be able to play alongside Miles Robinson, he can be a huge solution for the U.S., and he's such a young player that you want to give him opportunities to prove himself and to learn, right? What we've seen over the course of this cycle is Timothy Weah had an awful game against Panama, and now he's the best player on the U.S. men's national team. It takes some time, and these are learning experiences for these players. So Chris Richards made sense, and I thought he was solid in this game. Most of what Mikel Antonio did was down the left, and that's kind of what he's done in his three games for Jamaica. So I guess I could say that's what he always does. And Leon Bailey didn't really find that much space. And credit to Anthony Robinson as well for kind of locking him down a couple times. So I thought Richards had a solid game. With Busio, Doyle talked a little bit about, you know, him getting bypassed in midfield and the battles and all that stuff. I think Busio is a guy, in going back to, this is CONCACAF World Cup qualifying, it's a crappy field in Jamaica against Javon Watson, who could be his father, and everyone's playing super physical. I don't think this is a game for Gianluca Busio, and I don't know that it ever will be. Maybe he'll be good enough at the things he's great at to survive in a game like this, but I think with the options you have for the U.S., because you're not looking at two guys, right? You could have gone with Kyle McCosker. You could go with Sebastian Legette. Obviously, if McKennie's healthy, he's an option. Christian Roldan hasn't gotten a start in the entire tournament, and he's one of the best central midfielders in Major League Soccer. You do have other options for guys who I would say fit this game better. But at the same time, I think if you go to Europe and you play someone, you know, if you play Germany, then Busio maybe is the better player for a game like that. So I think it was a tough situation he got put in. But everything Greg Berhalter has said over the last 10 days is he believes Busio is a key part of what this team can be. He has clearly stated straight out, they get into the camp and he says, Busio's probably going to start one of these games. He's playing well enough to be a starter. We're really impressed by what we're seeing in Serie A. And that's part of Greg Berhalter's job, is helping these players develop. And a little bit of that is, you know, confidence and a carrot and something to work for and all those things. So you could see wanting to reward Busio. And I just think in the end, it wasn't the right game for him.
He's a 19-year-old. It's his first World Cup qualifying start. There were three teenagers.
Over. Never plays again. Bury him.
No.
Can't be.
Yeah, Pepe and Musa in this as well. Now Musa came out early, and he had strep throat. Pretty impressive to do what he did playing with that, by the way. I'm also being distracted. Right now, Football Vicente says 95% say that Tata should be out. So you sort of feel the... I'm honestly shocked 5% said he should be in. That's really the shocker.
Yeah, those are good polls.
In that poll. Five is also, according to a lot of the folks in the mentions, the amount of millions of dollars I have to pay to get him out of the contract. That is going to be a developing story. Well, what did we learn in this window? Like, what is Greg Berhalter going to take away and think about over the winter and apply next year? Is there any sort of grand takeaway to be had?
I think a couple things. I mean, one, you'll take 4 points, right? And you're right, you know, right off the top of the pace of the pack. You've beat your biggest rival, Dos Acero, in, you know, the match that mattered, that people said, you know, you've beaten them a couple times, but I thought it was really affirming in a way. And then, you go down to Jamaica and you don't play your best, but you walk away with with 1 point. And I think from an individual standpoint, Timothy Weah and Walker Zimmerman were the two standouts. If you look back at past windows, you go back to the last one where Brendan Aaronson, I believe, scored in two of the three matches. I can't remember if he had
goal
an assist
and
as well.
Assist, I think.
Goal and assist. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But you know, really emerged. There was no Gio. There was no, there were injuries throughout that window, and he really emerged as somebody that you could say, "Wow, this guy really is going to be a big part of things." Same with Miles Robinson in past windows as well. And I think when you look at just from an individual standpoint, I think those were the two biggest winners with Weah and Walker Zimmerman, who I think both have a real chance to be a starters. And look, that's what you want, really. Like we can go back and forth on this. Should Zach Steffen should have saved this shot from Mikel Antonio, or should Turner be in there? But ultimately, you want to have this competition, right? I wish we had that for the number nine position, as happy as I am with Pepe. Like, I really think the more you can get that, the better. That's not to say Christian's not going to be kind of the main guy, but I want somebody pushing him. I want somebody pushing Gio Reyna, and Gio Reyna needing to fight his way back into the team when he comes back in. Like, that's how a healthy team thrives. And that's where I wish, you know, maybe Busio did take on a bigger match tonight and, you know, push on to say, hey, I should be a starter as well too. You need that competition for places throughout the team. But I thought from the overall standpoint, those two were the biggest winners. And then, I 4 points from this window, I think, sets us up really nicely towards the last stretch.
I just think one of the things that comes to mind when Kalen's talking about the players that were able to rise in this camp is like Walker Zimmerman wasn't even called into the last camp originally, right? And then on injuries he comes in, and one of my points in that is like we have seen a lot of guys who have taken their MLS form and carried
it over. I didn't even mention Pepe.
Yeah,
was completely off the radar and then called in, and then, you know, or maybe not completely off the radar, but had not had a cap.
But that's what's really exciting to me about this December camp that the US is going to put together, because you know, Busio struggles in a game like this. Well, what does Georgi Mihailovic do in a game like this? And I'm not sure he's the right answer, but like we have now seen proof of concept that guys who are performing well at their club level, whatever that is, MLS or in Europe, they are able to bring that form over to the US. And I think there are players in the pool, or that will be in the pool when you have this camp, that can expand some of the things you do. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Aaron Herrera and what he could bring potentially to the US. And you know, Sergiño Dest, one, is a very specific player, and two, he's out injured. And I thought Yedlin did a fine job and actually had some nice moments against Mexico. There are also holes to his game, and there is clearly a lack of trust from Greg Berhalter that he's not locked in as his guy. And so I think there's some room to still improve this group, and I think there's still some room for Greg Berhalter to figure out his key components of his philosophy for this side. And we talked about this in the pregame, and Doyle mentioned he's gotten less cute with this side, but I don't know that they 100% know who they are at their best still. I would like to see them be even more aggressive with their press.
See, I actually disagree with that. I think we know that after the Mexico game. And so what I would take away from this window is that there's no competition for the first choice US midfield. And that's a good thing in the sense that when Musa McKennie and Adams are playing together, I think the U.S. has a chance against anybody. Those three guys are so good, and specifically so good together in the way that their skill sets sort of complement and enhance one another. So good. And then the downside is that there's no competition for the U.S. midfield. Like, there's not, based upon Busio tonight, Acosta and Legette last window, like, there's no comfortable backup for any of those guys. And I think if there's one thing that Greg Berhalter has to be worried about coming out of this camp, I think more so than the number nine backup situation, more so even than Gio Reyna's health or Sergiño Dest's health, it's, okay, what happens once we go back to these three-game windows? What happens when Tyler Adams picks up yellow card accumulation and has to miss a game? Who do we trust now? And it feels like we're further away from having answers to that than we were at the start of World Cup qualifying. So as good a position as the U.S. are in right now, it's also really, really tenuous. And that's a worry. That's a worry going into the next 2 months.
The next 2 months look like this. We're back in January, at the end of January into early Feb, 127, January 27th, El Salvador at home. The 30th at Canada, looking increasingly like that's going to be Toronto. John Herdman's in the media right now talking about how, you know, look, this is not a national tour. You have to understand the realities of travel. David Goss is going to make a good coin off that as he arranges the back and forth from Central America for the Canadian national team. And then home against Honduras. So two home games.
You don't need tickets. I got a guy. I got friends. I know people. We won't even issue tickets. We'll just shuttle you through the back door. Don't worry about it.
We'll get you in. You'll be there. Don't worry about it. You'll be there. So at Canada is the big game in that first three-game window, and then home games against El Salvador and Honduras. And then two away games in the final window at Mexico to start it off on March 24th. Panama at home, a huge match, we assume. We'll see what happens in the next two for Panama to set themselves up for that last four, three games of which will be against Canada, U.S., and Mexico. And then finally, the finale at Costa Rica, where we know things did not go quite so well the last time around for the U.S. So, any final thoughts? Who makes the World Cup? We're 8 games in of 14. Is it going to be U.S., Mexico, and Canada? Would you be brave enough to say something like that, or is...
I would say that. Okay. I feel confident in saying U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
Yeah, but no disrespect to Panama, who have been amazingly gritty throughout this entire qualification process. Like their 3-2 win at Honduras on Thursday or Friday, whatever. I have no idea what day today is. But last week, their 3-2 win. That's like the game of the Ocho so far. So no disrespect to Panama at all, but I still think that the Canada, the U.S., and Mexico are favored to finish the top three.
Pat Onstead, make sure Coco Carrasquilla is coming back. He's a baller.
Well, they're tweeting tonight. So I don't know if the social team knows something extra as well about what's going to happen with Coco. But
the Galaxy are all up in the El Tree conversation tonight.
Oh, man.
Respect.
Any final thoughts? We can call this one good, boys. And we're calling it good. Thursday, Audi 2021 MLS Cup playoffs preview. The games start on Saturday and Sunday. MLSsoccer.com is your home for all the coverage, or the MLS app if that's more your style on that one. Get ready for those. We'll get you ready for those. And if you haven't caught the Continental Tire Awards from Monday, please go back and do so. Subscribe, rate us on iTunes, wherever you listen. That's it for us on Club and Country. Driven by Continental Tire. We'll see you on Thursday, everybody.
Congrats to Canada.
Congrats to Canada.